Hello, everybody. It's Michael Marsalek. I'm in our studios today. William Marcus is with me, and we're going to spend the next hour listening to some tape and talking a little bit about your amazing career with Montana Public Radio, retiring this coming week after 40 years working for Montana Public Radio. It must be an amazing time for you.
It is. I mean, this job is really the only one I ever had. I came to Missoula in 1970 to go to school at the University of Montana and really never left. I mean, never left campus, let alone Missoula. And I feel like I'm finally graduating from U of M. So
you were one of the first official employees for KUFM Radio doing production. And you came into this through a love of media, right? I mean, you were in one of Terry's first classes, is that right?
Yeah, he gave me a C in radio production. And I actually had come into the School of Journalism through the darkroom because I wanted to use the darkroom on campus. It was the best one on campus, so I went to Don Miller, who was teaching photography, and he said, well, you can use it if you're a major. So I said, sign me up, and started taking the radio classes and found a real home immediately. The world of sound, music, I knew something about classical music because I studied piano. So it just felt good to be there. It was a great home. And Phil Hess had started the station about 10 years earlier. And in 1985, I did a KUFM at 20 program, and I interviewed Phil about those early days at KUFM.
I was asked by Nathan Blumberg to start a radio station.
Was that an exciting possibility to you, or a
burden? Oh, yeah. I had worked in TV, but, I had worked in radio going way back. We have ordered a new textbook for a new course called Intro to Mass Media. And that book says, and I quote verbatim, pioneer disc jockeys played some 78 RPM records, now mostly forgotten except by record collectors, end of quote. So I can claim and can show some evidence that I am a pioneer disc jockey. We got the station on the air in January of 65. We started at 10 watts. 10 watts of FM is not very much. With a strong Hellgate breeze, our signal could be heard all the way across Higgins Avenue. We had a story in the paper that we were going to go on the air, and we had a listener. I will never forget that first phone call. I was sitting in the control room, and the telephone rang, and it was somebody who said, I heard you.
Phil's voice by that time was pretty severely affected by MS, but he was the man who hired me, really, in 1975. The station had just become an NPR member and CPB qualified, and because of that, they had to have 5 full-time members. So I just happened to be in the right place at the right time.
Well, and here many years later, we were able to put the last station on the air, in the just about the last station on the air in Polson, and name it after Phil, KPJH.
Yeah, KPJH, yeah. And of course, Terry Conrad was, as I said, my teacher and mentor. I mean, public radio was totally new here. It was new in the country. But Terry had worked at WDET in Detroit, which was a community station, and came with, you know, what it meant to be a public station. And he was in that KUFM at 20 show, too.
Well, one of the pleasures of working in this kind of radio is watching people who have never had any experience on radio become very good at it. All of the people that come to work on the radio bring something to it. A radio station and all of the equipment and everything is just a set of tools, and all of the people that end up doing programs are doing them because they have something to share with the audience. Almost all of them have had no experience at all when they come on initially, and it's fun to teach them how to turn on the machines and watch them get nervous. And then watch them grow, and then watch them get over that, and listen to them get over that, and listen to them use radio in a very effective way and present some wonderful things for people.
And that's pretty much Terry's philosophy for the station, was that if you found people who had a love of music, that he could teach them how to run the equipment, but he couldn't teach them to have a passion for something.
So if I understand the story correctly, William, in the early years, there was fighting over tape at one point, which literally turned into the first effort to go on the air and say, listener, can you help us? And of course, that's evolved into this incredible thing system-wide, and of course in Montana, legendary fundraising, from what, $3,000 in that first ask to a $700,000 public radio week this last spring.
I was going through, throwing things out of my office. I came across a note that Phil had written to me for the second fundraiser, and he said, fantastic result, $6,900 and some dollars. And it was like, man, that was so long ago. But yeah, ever since that first time when we opened the mics and said, can you help us, it has never ceased to amaze me the amount of love and support that's out there for Montana Public Radio.
Well, and Montana Public Radio was one of the early adopters, early connections to become a network affiliate status with NPR,
right.
And relationships were built, and you had pieces early on, Performance Today, and pitching to the network in various ways. Talk about that a little bit.
I did, and it all pretty much started with Kim Williams. You know, Kim came to the station. Phil thought she had a great voice and great ideas. He pitched her to the network. So I would always record Kim's pieces and send them off to All Things Considered. So I knew the people there, kind of, and when I got to go to Washington, I went to visit. And Jill Hoyt, who was our news director at the time, was also doing some NPR pieces, which I mixed for her. And I was doing some sound for her, and I thought, you know, I could probably do some of these stories myself. So I pitched a story to Larry Abramson, who's now the dean of the School of Journalism, and this is 85, 86, and said, I'd like to do a fly fishing piece. And he said, sure, never heard from anybody in Montana before, so send it in. And I went out on the Bitterroot River and had really just one piece of luck after the other with the guys I went out with and the sound that happened. And this is fly fishing on the Bitterroot River.
This is high water, see, so this is...
It's a cold, rainy morning on the Bitterroot River in western Montana. John Faust, who owns the Fish House Tackle Shop in nearby Hamilton, is stirring up the rocks in the river, hoping that nymphs under the rocks will be flushed into a screen he holds downstream. Underwater gardening, he calls it.
See all the little insects that's in here? See them crawling around in there? See, now that would give us an indication of what fly to use when we started fishing. Now, there isn't very many here, so we'll move down here just a little tiny ways.
The nymphs will hatch into flying insects that Faust copies in his hand-tied flies, matching size and proportion with fur, feathers, and thread wrapped around a hook. While Faust stirs up more bottom rocks, Doug Swisher, one of Montana's best-known fly fishermen, comes over to check the new collection squirming on the screen.
What do you got here, a good-sized stonefly? Well, you look, here's a little mayfly nymph, and then there's a stonefly. Once you identify these species, then you kind of know what's going on. We know that this little mayfly, for example, is going to hatch the last week in May, and it usually hatches about the middle of the afternoon. And so if you show up at that time with the right imitation, your chances of getting into trout just go up drastically. Take 5 minutes, do your underwater gardening, and you can learn a lot of valuable information about fishing.
There's no obvious hatch taking place in the cold morning air, so Swisher selects a large, bristling fly with slender rubber tubing tied to form an X. The fly is his own creation. He calls it Madam X.
This is a tractor dry fly that I like to use. And I still maintain it. You know, it's a funny-looking fly with those big old round rubber legs, but I think the reason the fish hit it is action. It's pretty hard to beat a fly if it has good action. If it's doing something lifelike out there in the water, that really turns the fish on. So if you have the ability on top of that to lay it right where you want it and make it float like a natural, and then it has some built-in action, you got a real combination there. Now anyway, get a little more line out here and shoot it up in that little riffle. That little riffle that's coming into that quiet water. Now, that's a good spot, I would think, because the current is going to carry those bugs right down that funnel system. And then right along the edge is that quiet water. In fact, we even have a little back eddy there. Fish love to lay in those back eddies because the water's quiet, yet they're right next to the old conveyor belt system bringing their food.
Each of Swisher's casts lands with precision in the swirls and eddies and the quiet pools, which reflect a passing flock of geese.
Ah, there we go, right where I want it. Oh, darn it, he missed it. Well, that's the way it goes. All right, I'll just keep fishing some of this water over here.
Swisher moves to fish in deeper water. It's raining harder now, and John Faust seeks shelter from the rain under the tall ponderosa pine on shore and watches his friend fish.
You notice how he's casting there. Every cast is just right on for, you know, it's not the longest cast in the world, but the cast is doing just exactly what he wants it to do, and he knows just exactly where that's going to light. But he's done it for a long time, and he does it darn near every day. It looks like Doug's going to give it up there.
They're mean today, aren't they, Doug?
Oh, I don't know. Right now, I guess it just depends how bad you want to fish.
The Swisher is soaked from the rain. He hasn't caught any fish today, but he's not disappointed.
You know, there are some days when God himself can't catch a trout, and you have to accept that. No matter how good you are, you may not catch a trout. So in those days, you know, I don't get mad at anybody. I get out here and I work a little harder on all my different casts, working my accuracy, and I get satisfaction in that because casting in itself is a sport, and it just plain feels good to do it right, just like anything else. To me, it's like a master chess game trying to figure out what's going to happen, and that's one of the beauties of fly fishing. You know, you get aggressive, you attack it. And I think that's what the modern-day man is looking for, sports and pastimes that either tax him mentally or physically or both. And I think fly fishing does a great blend of both things. And there's days you don't catch fish. So I think today it's really a matter of timing. I think the optimum time for fishing today would probably be 3 to 5 o'clock.
Will you be out here 3 to 5 today?
I don't know. If I'm not physically, I will be mentally. I've been known to sneak off when the time comes. We'll see how it goes.
The early fishing season in Montana is expected to be very good because of low stream levels and clear water, the result of low snowpack in the northern Rockies. But fishermen like Doug Swisher fear the streams will be dangerously low by summer, although recent rains promise relief for the endangered streams and fish. For National Public Radio, this is William Marcus on the Bitterroot River in Montana.
Telling stories about Montanans and Montana is obviously something that you've really made a life's work about.
Montanans are very genuine. They're very generous. And they just have great stories. And if you can find a good story, put them in a place, it makes great radio. And one way I was able to interview authors, because generally one of the hosts would interview an author, but I told my editor, I can take that author and put them in the place that they are writing about. So I knew that they wanted to hear Montana, and I was ready to, you know, showcase the best of Montana. And Greg Morley up in Swan Lake still to this day makes beautiful canoes. I walked into Greg's shop in Swan Lake and asked him about his canoes.
When you walk into this small converted car garage that sits across the highway from Swan Lake in northwestern Montana, your nose wrinkles from the odor of fiberglass. Its plastic bitterness conflicts with the wooden glow of the canoes, kayaks, skiffs, and dories that sit in Greg Morley's showroom and workshop. Morley has been making canoes for 15 years using a method developed in Minnesota that utilizes thin cedar strips glued together over a mold and coated with fiberglass. Each strip is about an inch wide and 3/16 of an inch thick, giving the crafts a graceful, intricate look. Morley's workshop has few power tools. There is a bandsaw, a planer for getting the strips a uniform thickness, a shaper that finishes the edges so they fit together when glued, and a sander to even out the surface before fiberglassing. Greg Morley works in this shop 8 hours a day, 4 or 5 days a week, and produces only 20 to 25 boats a year.
There is a lot of skill and a lot of time and commitment to doing it. I feel it's important to have a very high quality product, and there's a limit as to what I can charge for it. So there's a lot of work that goes into this, and only a moderate financial return. Long ago we decided what was important, financially and time-wise, recreation-wise, whatever you want to call it, and have been able to hold to that schedule. We don't have a great desire for a lot of things. We have everything we need here.
Greg Morley is not in the canoe business to get rich, but he is still very much a businessman. His current project in the shop shows that he keeps a close eye on the market in recreational equipment.
This is the beginnings of a 16-foot rowing shell. A few years ago, rowing seemed to be taking off the way bicycling did back in the 70s. And it has. There are a lot of canoe companies have shifted to be able to make rowing shells also. So a few years ago, I started doing that. They're a light, fast hull in the water. It's a recreational type, so it's not competitive, not for racing, but for exercise and enjoyment of that feeling of speed out on the lake.
I was not interested in a rowing workout, but I did want to take a ride. So Morley and I loaded a new 18-foot canoe onto his pickup.
People stop you in parking lots when you have your boat on the roof and talk about your canoe?
Yes, all the time. On the roof or when I'm launching any place, even down here at the local campground, when launching a boat, I have people come flocking in. People that were unaware of what the boats really looked like. It's hard to get away sometimes. That's how most of my sales occur, is from word of mouth and people seeing the boats more than anything else.
Paddling on a secluded lake, 5 miles in toward the Swan Range, Greg Morley was a gentle salesman.
They're a light, portable, fast little boat. It doesn't take any other power, just human power. Their shape makes me feel good. The slim, water-efficient designs are fun to work with, building and paddling them. I like getting out into the wild, too, like this, paddling along the edges of a beautiful mountain lake, also running rivers, watch the animals along the shoreline and in the water, and just be in that situation. I used to fish a lot, and don't do very much of that anymore because I just enjoy paddling along and watching everything else. The fishing gets in the way.
Morley has made over 300 boats. Some are at work off the coast of Maine or in California. Others were purchased for display as art objects. Whatever their fate, Morley keeps detailed records on them. He likes knowing where they are.
At first, it was very hard to work all that time building a nice, sleek canoe that I'd much rather be out paddling myself somewhere and to see it go out the door and be left with just this check or money in my hand, and then start all over again, building another one for the next person. It's easier now, especially with two boys in college. I need the money, but but still, I do mentally hang on to the boats, too, each one of them.
The late naturalist Sigurd Olsen wrote, "A man is part of his canoe, and therefore part of all it knows." Greg Morley has used his knowledge of canoes to build a business and a way of life. As he paddled us to shore, it was easy to see the balance and beauty of the canoe as a clear reflection of his success. For National Public Radio, I'm William Marcus in Swan Lake, Montana.
When you started creating radio, you were still working with a razor blade and quarter-inch reel-to-reel tape. Montana Public Radio is now, 12 different translators and transmitters all over the western part of Montana. started as the little 10-watt service here at the University of Montana. How did the expansion come about?
The first expansion was in the 70s. E.B. Craney in Butte gave Phil Hess the money to put a translator on in Butte, and suddenly we were a regional service. We had some trouble with having a transmitter on campus, so the University of Montana invested in putting the station at the top of Snow Bowl, basically, and suddenly we could be heard from Kalispell to Darby. So we made those kind of sudden leaps just by happenstance, really. After that, people started calling us to say, gee, we'd really like to have public radio in Helena or in Great Falls.
In many of those cases, it was the first time public broadcasting services were available in those communities, mm-hmm. too.
People really wanted public radio. They'd heard about it, and they wanted to wake up in their community and hear it.
I'm talking with William Marcus today. We're celebrating his 40-year career at Montana Public Radio, just in advance of his retirement. This is fun listening to the old tape.
When I took the job as interim director in 93, one thing I said is I'd really like to stay on the radio. It's really important to me. So I still have done that Monday morning shift from Morning Edition through Freeforms. But I really had to drop a lot of the NPR work because it just takes too much time. But I have done a couple since then. One is with author Pete Fromm, who one of his first publications was Indian Creek Chronicles. He had spent a winter in the Selway wilderness, Selway Bitterroot wilderness, watching a fish hatchery place, kind of getting the eggs through the winter time so they wouldn't freeze over. And again, saying to my editor at NPR, here's a great book, an interesting author, I can go back to Indian Creek with Pete Fromm. And my editor said, well, why don't you do that?
The Selway River has carved a narrow, deep valley through the Bitterroot Mountains. The steep rock walls and heavy timber cast shadows on the water. It looks cold and threatening. The valley widens slightly where Indian Creek joins the river, creating a meadow rimmed by ponderosa pine trees and riverbank bushes. Pete Fromm camped here in a 14 by 16 foot wall tent in the winter of 1979. He'd taken a job watching over a salmon hatchery channel for the Idaho Fish and Game Department. At the time, he didn't know what a wall tent was. He was a 20-year-old wildlife biology major at the University of Montana, paying his tuition with a swimming scholarship. Fromm says he accepted the work on Indian Creek so he'd have stories to tell his friends.
I was thinking, you know, there's nothing that I've ever done that I can tell. Who wants to hear about my paper route? Who wants to hear about the time I was swimming in the pool back and forth over a black line on the bottom? So this job to come in here, this would be something to tell about. Not everybody's done this.
It's a short walk from the campsite to Indian Creek, which is ice cold and carries a faint taste of the granite rocks it tumbles over. But Fromm says that during the winter he spent here, the creek froze over and a quiet loneliness closed in. To distract himself, he established a routine, gathering firewood, mastering the technique of baking in his small wood stove, and learning how to walk in snowshoes. He writes that he dreaded any breakdown in the regimen, like burning a loaf of bread.
Small failures like that could set off some desperate swings to loneliness so powerful it would make me fight for breath. Then tiny victories, like pulling my first golden loaf of bread from the wood stove, would send me into idiotic charges through my meadow, laughing and carrying on as if I just won the lottery. Each one of those victories, as minor as they were, cut a piece out of the loneliness that always skulked nearby, and the dark patches of trees, and the black water trying hard not to freeze over, even in the way the river talked at night, taking on voices it never had in the day. A hollow began to shape for me in the woods, and I grew comfortable in it.
Fromm chronicled the days, good and bad, in a journal. The writing started out as a simple record of weather conditions and daily activity, but Fromm began using the entries to analyze his state of mind.
I became my own experiment. I wanted to see when is this going to become more comfortable. And the writing changed from good day, bad day, to describing the day in fairly great detail, so I was showing myself what kind of day it was.
Fromm doesn't dwell on the emotionally desperate times in the book. They do surface in the retelling of his exhausting search for his father and brother, who attempted to cross-country ski the 40 miles to Pete's camp. The temperature plunged to 40 degrees below zero, and they were overdue. Fromm dropped the pack and coat that were weighing him down and hurried off to meet them.
But at each turn, I only saw yet another barren stretch of snow-covered road and snow-covered creek and snow-covered trees. My grin faded each time, but never quite went away. I'd need it at the next turn. I walked for quite a while before I felt the cold. I started walking faster, waiting for the warmth to come, waiting to see the skiers moving darkly against the white world before me. And I walked faster still, without touching the cold. Finally, after only 3 miles or so, I had to turn around. I'd never felt anything like this cold. My pack and coat were a couple of miles away, and suddenly that distance was frightening. I took just enough time to make a sign in the snow out of sticks, telling them I was at Magruder. Then I stood a moment more, arms wrapped around my chest, looking up the road, trying to will them to turn the corner before I had to walk away from them.
Fromm says he worked hard to keep his personal reflections out of the book, because he thinks much of nature writing is too preachy. He didn't want to rob his readers of the chance to react.
They'd see what I would see, hear what I heard, feel what I felt, all that, and then be able to draw their own conclusions. Don't have me say, and then this is how you should feel right now. Let them do the mental, the emotional part themselves.
At one point, however, Fromm does react. He's describing an out-of-state hunter who is about to shoot a mountain lion that's been treed by his hunting guide's dogs.
I kept waiting for the shot until finally I needed to take a breath. I looked away from the lion and the tree, hunching my shoulders in case the shot should come now that I was beginning not to expect it. I glanced at Phil just as he lowered his gun, and for an instant I'd hoped he'd realize what a letdown a shot would be after having seen the power unleashed in the lion's wild freefall down the draw. But in one big rush, Phil let out the breath he'd held and laughed nervously. I saw him shake the tension out of his arms and rotate his head, getting the kinks out. Then he brought his elbow back to his knees and his eyes back to his sights. He just held his breath too long, and now he's ready again. Maybe he hadn't thought about what he was doing at all. I couldn't tell. Maybe he had, but thought that this far into it, it would be impossible to back down.
Echoed in the lion hunter's reluctant shot is Fromm's own resolution to stick it out alone through the winter. While the hunter ended up with a trophy rug for his den, Fromm says his own ordeal brought a different bounty.
Overwhelming self-confidence. I really do think I can do anything. Becoming a writer. Sold one short story to Louisiana Literature and quit my job because now I was a professional writer. And people telling me, you know, that it won't ever happen. You'll starve.
Before we left Indian Creek, we climbed the side of Indian Ridge, a steep mountain that rises high above the dark valley floor. From its slope, you can see the sun glinting off segments of the Selway River. When asked why it's taken him 14 years to write his book, Fromm gazes across the vast landscape that has beckoned young adventurers for centuries, a place that was both his sanctuary and prison.
There were 2 weeks after I learned I was going to do this before I came in, and it was great to go tell people what I was going to do, because it would wow their socks off. But afterwards, the myth had so completely disintegrated that I really did not talk about it very much. Because it's a long story.
Pete Fromm, author of Indian Creek Chronicles. His book is published by Lyons and Burford. For National Public Radio, I'm William Marcus in Missoula, Montana.
It's nothing like going to the location like that and being able to capture so clearly a story. I think that radio does that better than just about any medium. I know you love radio.
I've always said the pictures are much better on the radio, because the sounds that you hear, you connect to sounds in your own experience, and you have the pictures that go along with it. So when you hear the sound of a river and wind in trees, that picture comes to mind. And in television, which I love as well, you have to have a picture for every single idea or word. And in radio, they're just all in your head.
William, those that know you're a news guy. You stay connected. You read, listen all the time, consume news. But you've also managed to stay so connected to music. Obviously, musically trained yourself, but I remember going to St. Timothy's for recordings of the Muir String Quartet, which you did many years, and Also finding great stories about musicians. Gene Roble.
Gene Roble was an icon of music in Montana. She had a national career. She was a mentor and guide and inspiration to more than a generation of musicians. She had a nice little grand piano in her front room just outside Hamilton. Jean Roble says she always knew she'd be a piano player, even though when she was young, she got some conflicting advice.
I remember I went to a little lady in town that read tea leaves. Now, I was probably in the fourth or fifth grade. She said, "Oh, I can see you sitting on a grand piano." On it. Now, she didn't mean at it. I thought, oh, I'm supposed to learn how to sing something.
While she did go on to do some singing, the piano always came first. Fascination with the instrument began when she was 5 years old, and her family rented a house that already had a piano in a small music room. Her mother had her own piano and moved it in to face the other one, with just enough room between them for a piano bench.
I was in seventh heaven. Now, I don't know why playing one with one hand and one with the other was any different than putting two hands on one piano, but to me it was. It was a monstrous thing to do. And I remember the first song I played was The Sheikh of Araby.
Roble learned the tune from a friend who whistled it for her one day on the school bus. She went home and picked out the melody on the piano. Until a few years ago, when she learned to read music, Roble played everything by ear. In high school, she learned tunes off the radio, modeling herself after Teddy Wilson, the pianist in Benny Goodman's quartet. After high school, Roble decided she had to find Wilson. In 1941, she took the train from Montana to New York and tracked him down in a club.
And I said, "Now, if you don't give me lessons, I'm going back to Montana." And he said, "Montana?" I said, "Yeah." And he said, "My wife is from Anaconda."
Roble says that's probably the only reason Wilson agreed to give her lessons. She studied with him for 2 years, working without music scores, concentrating on sound and feeling.
His main idea was my chords, the way I came out sounding. There's a difference between this, and it's the same sound. It's the same thing, and I can't explain it. I've never sounded to myself the way I want to sound. No musician does. This is what keeps you fired. It stokes the stove in you to keep trying.
Roble eventually signed with the William Morris Agency as Jean Hamilton, taking her stage name from her small Mountain Valley hometown. She played the supper club and piano bar circuit from New Jersey to Detroit. At one stop in Buffalo, she met three young brothers, Hank, Elvin, and Thad Jones, who were anxious to get to New York City. She gave them her agent's number and says he never stopped thanking her. At the Onyx Club in New York, she played and sang during the band breaks. The headliner was Billie Holiday.
We shared a dressing room, and I was scared to death to talk to her, but she was very nice to me. At the time, I don't remember thinking that, oh, isn't this great? You know, I didn't. I think I was too dumb to know what great was and how lucky I was.
Mm-hmm.
Robel's hard-driving piano style and sprightly stage presence landed her a slot on a radio contest at WJZ, the flagship station of NBC's Blue Network.
Well, that was great, Gene Haviland. Gene, you play with such a sturdy touch that you might almost forgive the audience for thinking you were a man.
Well, I get that all the time. But as you can see, I'm all girl.
Not even a yard wide.
No. I'm a rancher's daughter from the plains of Montana.
Well, that's one for the books. A rancher's daughter from the Montana setting sophisticated Broadway aflame with a swing of music. Now, how did you get the book?
Oh, whoever wrote those scripts, I'll never know. I trained it one time. We went through it two or three times, you know. The first one said, I'm from the plains of Montana. And I said, I'm not from the plains of Montana. There's mountains there. They wouldn't let me say it. I thought, geez, I didn't like that. I'd rather just go play the piano someplace.
The radio contest led to a part in the movie On Stage, Everybody, with Jack Oakey and Julie London. But Robel, who had always played what and how she liked, found she had a little leeway in Hollywood.
They told me what I had to play, and it had to be Boogie Woogie. And I said, oh, no, let me play something else. Well, I'd played a lot of Boogie Woogie. So they told me it had to be 2 minutes and 14 seconds long. And that wasn't the way I wanted to play the piano.
After her dismal Hollywood experience and an exhaustive cast tour that left her in bad health, Jean cut back on her performing and married Norm Robel, an RKO theater manager in St. Paul, Minnesota. The couple eventually moved back to Hamilton, Montana, and Jean renewed her career, playing piano in a Missoula supper club, driving the 100-mile round trip from her home 4 days a week for 35 years.
I went through three Volkswagens, two Chevrolets, and one Mustang.
And became a local legend. Even college students and younger musicians would go to see her, including Maureen Powell and David Horgan, members of the swing band The Big Sky Mudflaps.
One of the most important things for a young child to witness is somebody doing what they love and doing it well. And after you hear Gene, if you're inclined to love music anyway, it's hard not to want to pursue it.
She's the first person who made me realize that jazz can be just as visceral, just as physical. It can get you off your feet just as much as rock and roll can. And it really was startling for somebody like me at that point.
Young musicians who know her say Robel's a generous, attentive fan. Robel says the best thing she can do for them is to help them find their own voices in the music. That's what Teddy Wilson taught her.
But I know if somebody had said, what's your greatest wish? It would have been to play just like him. But that isn't what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to play your own thing. That's what music is. That's what makes jazz what it is. And I've finally gotten that in my head.
Jean Robel still plays as often as she's asked, but she says gigs are harder to come by these days because most bars and clubs don't even have a piano. For National Public Radio, I'm William Marcus in Missoula, Montana.
This is NPR's Weekend Edition. I'm Leanne Hansen.
I had to get that last laugh in there. I mean, she had such a fabulous laugh. I've always liked that piece a lot. She was a gift. Let's listen to some more sound. Peter Stark is not only a great writer, he's my neighbor, and I often had seen him out in the yard in the wintertime. He would do winter camping in his backyard, and little did I know that he was working on a book about winter stories. And I thought it would be a great thing to go out in the winter with Peter and pitch that story to my editor at NPR. And it just happened that Peter and John Kinberger were going ice climbing. And I said, can I go along? And there I was going ice climbing. I didn't go ice climbing. They did, but I went along.
We're entering the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness area.
This wilderness area is a popular recreation spot in summer, but today there's no one around. The only tracks in the snow were left by a large moose. Peter Stark and his friend and guide John Kinberger are hiking down a narrow trail leading to the bottom of the Little Rock Creek drainage near Como Lake. Stark is looking for ice, not to skate on, but to climb. After a 45-minute walk, Kinberger spots our destination.
There's your first glimpse of Dynamo Flow.
Dynamo Flow forms when seeping groundwater freezes. The 75-foot column of bluish-green ice cascades from the cliff above us like a frozen waterfall. Its rough, milky surface has captured a dusting of fresh snow, and it glistens against the dark rock face of the canyon. The countless variations of ice and snow are part of what Stark loves about winter.
There's the genius of nature for creating these odd substances, snow and ice, and then there's a certain human genius that tries to figure out what you can do with them.
We leave the trail and bushwhack our way up the steep hillside over boulders and underbrush. This will be Stark's first experience with ice climbing. Dynamo Flow only forms when there's enough groundwater, and the sight of the ice energizes the climbers.
I just say it gets the old heart to pumping.
This lower section is more like a low angle three. Maybe even a...
Most sites frequented by climbers are given numerical ratings that relate to the steepness and difficulty of the ice, with a 1 being an easy walk and a 7 being a vertical face with thin ice.
The middle section, which we're going to climb up there, is more of a solid 3.
A 3 means that the ice face approaches 80 degrees, but Stark has his own rating method.
This first part is, if I fall, I'm okay range. Next part is the broken bone range, and then way up there is I'm going to die range.
For Stark, the climb will be more than he anticipated, but he trusts ice.
It's incredibly strong in some ways, yet brittle in other ways. In a glacier, it can bend. I think I've described it as the original miracle plastic in some ways. So in that sense, I feel comfortable with the concept of ice itself, but it's the verticality of it that's new to me.
Stark began to appreciate ice when he discovered that a slippery surface could be a great equalizer. He was a shy, small child, but he excelled at gliding on blades and sled runners, often outrunning the larger boys. He writes about it in an essay called A Life Built on Snow.
I collected the secrets of snow and ice the way that other boys collected snakes and rocks, and savored the power of ice heaves and avalanches like other boys keened after fighter planes and large guns. This was a problem because there are no avalanches in the cornfields of Wisconsin. I thus built my own by stacking large cardboard blocks into a cornice-like ledge at the top of the basement stairs and, having thoughtfully distributed toy Green Bay Packer football helmets to them for head protection against the concrete wall at the bottom, lured my younger brother and sister to join me on the shaky perch until it collapsed under our weight and swept us down in an avalanche of cardboard.
As Stark prepares for his climb, he straps on his current headgear, a battered white motorcycle helmet, a remnant of his downhill ski racing days. Lashed to the bottom of his boots are a set of crampons, inch-and-a-half-long steel daggers that bite into the ice as he walks. 2 saw-like steel fangs jut out in front. They'll be kicked into the ice wall to form a foothold. The wicked steel blades would be more at home on medieval armor than they are on Stark's round, plastic, bright purple boots. Guy John Kinberger is decked out in a sky blue jacket and hot pink snowboarding pants.
You've got some outrageous colors.
The men are ready to climb. Around his waist, Kinberger carries the hardware of ice climbing, ice screws and bolts that will hold oval metal clamps called carabiners to the ice. Thick nylon ropes will be laced through the anchored carabiners and fastened to Stark to keep him from falling more than a few feet. Kinberger is free climbing, relying on the strength of his broad shoulders, thick arms, two vicious-looking ice axes, and the crampons on his gray boots to maneuver up the first section of Dynamo Flow. Ice chips fly everywhere. Stark cranes his neck and watches intently.
Well, it's amazing to see the way he sticks to the ice. It's like Spider-Man going right up there. And it looks fun.
Kinberger anchors a carabiner at the top of the first section and pulls the rope tight to the ice wall. Stark is tied in and ready to go.
Okay, climbing! Where do I begin?
After several shallow axe blows that simply shatter the surface ice, Stark gets a good plant.
That sounds kind of hollow, that one.
Well, maybe not. His progress is slow.
Man, these axes really work.
The first section is about 25 feet high. It takes Stark 10 minutes to climb. There's a level spot at the top of the first section, and Stark turns around. He's climbed above the treetops, and he can see the cliffs on the other side of the drainage.
Hello! Hello!
Stark returns to the ice and starts up the I'm gonna die range.
Man, this is vertical.
The confidence he gained in the initial climb begins to crumble like the ice around him. He's tired. With one axe blow, a section of ice the size of a trash can lid gives way. Stark said later that he almost panicked, but he says that excitement is why he's here, and it's a test to see if he can summon the intense concentration that you need to get out of a tough situation.
I couldn't hammer with enough arm strength to set the ice axe in, and so I was smashing and fumbling around up there. And that ice is flying off into your, chipping off into your face. That's the transporting part of the experience, that you're so totally absorbed in what you're doing. It's as if nothing else exists.
The feeling is familiar to Stark. He says he's felt it while hurtling down a mountain slope on skis at 70 miles an hour or careening through a luge run. He tries to explain it in his book.
It's as if your nervous system shifts over from the flickering circuitry of daily consciousness to older and deeper neural pathways, and you react as fast and instinctively as a deer that darts and dodges through thick woods.
Stark rappels to the bottom of the cliff. His chin is bleeding, cut by an ice chunk, but he touches the frozen surface with something like a caress and peers into the ice.
I used to love to, when I was a child, lie down on the ice and put your face right against it and look at the air bubbles, and they're like little cities down there. And then, of course, when you're a kid, you take a big rock and you smash it like that and see the cracks shoot out and destroy the city.
Stark seems a little surprised by his childish outburst. As if to atone, he takes his ice axe and gently plays a group of small icicles.
There you have an icicle concert.
During the hike out, nobody says a word. Peter Stark and John Kinberger are exhausted. We arrive home well after dark. When I call the next morning to check in with Stark, his wife says he's out, playing hockey. For National Public Radio, I'm William Marcus in Missoula, Montana.
Well, we've talked a lot about the sound that are in these pieces. The other thing that I wanted to be able to present with the NPR family out there was just the strength of writing in Montana. And of course, that all came together when The Last Best Place was published.
Even at 1,000 pages, The Last Best Place is a concentrated sampling of Montana writing. The editors, working with an advisory board of historians, writers, and teachers, collected over 3,000 pages of high-quality material in their research. The book begins with Native American stories and journals of early explorers and fur traders. In the 1800s, the Missouri River brought wave after wave of immigrants to Montana. Editor Bill Kittredge thinks many of them dealt with the new, often hostile environment by writing about it, a process which continues today.
People live by stories, and if we're not going to go nuts, we have some kind of story that we live within, some story we inhabit. And this accumulation of stories is a way for the state and the people in the state to see themselves mirrored, to see who they are, to see who they might be, to see what's valuable here and what's not valuable. And I think it's extremely healthy.
The serious literature that was part of this storytelling was first nurtured by Professor H.G. Merriam, who started the creative writing program at the University of Montana in 1919. Much of the material in The Last Best Place first appeared in Merriam's quarterly journal, Frontier and Midland, published from 1920 to 1939. Contributors included Wallace Stegner, A.B. Guthrie Jr., and Dorothy Johnson. This commitment to serious writing was strengthened again in 1964 when poet Richard Hugo arrived in Montana to lead the creative writing program. Hugo thought that good literature could be written in everyday language and be based on everyday experiences. James Welch, a Native American writer, was one of Hugo's first students. Welch wanted to write about the people and landscape of Montana's Northern Plains country and the Blackfeet Indian Reservation where he grew up. Before taking Hugo's class, he was writing romantic poems about an idealized land peopled with heroic figures.
Dick Hugo really showed me that you could write seriously about that country. And he also taught me that the country was important in a way that people would appreciate it if you could write well about it. And this was a revelation to me, so I worked hard at it, and he was right.
Bill Kittredge credits Richard Hugo with moving Montana literature toward a new story, one less caught up in the myths of conquest and exploitation.
It's a story about being good to people. It's a story about accepting people. It's a story about human frailty and being compassionate and humane, and not a story about conquest and takeover, as I say. And when it began to occur to people that it was okay to write about the things that had happened to you in your ordinary life, suddenly literature became possible in Montana in a way that was very difficult before in the West.
My granddad helped his dad build this barn when my granddad was 12 years old. It was the first building.
Ralph Beer is a third-generation Montanan who returned to his family's ranch after his years in the military. The ranch sits on a windy ridge overlooking the Elkhorn Mountains south of Helena. Beer spent many evenings here listening to his grandfather tell stories about ranch life. Those stories surfaced when Beer began taking creative writing classes.
Once I started trying to write, I found that I kept wanting to write about one thing, and it was this place. I'm coming back up here and kind of rediscovering this place and healing up, in a way, kind of finding myself again.
After his critically acclaimed first novel, The Blind Corral, was published, Beer wrote even more directly about changing Western values in an essay for Harper's Magazine. In it, he weighs those traditional values against the realities of land speculation, corporate ranching, and the careless dramatization of Western life on television.
For many of us, there is a continuous myth-making process, a steady reinventing and renewal of ourselves, which is generated and defined by one aspect of our rural lives more than by anything else, our sense of place. But the myths are wearing thin. The lonesome horseman, once the central image of the Western myth, now lives in an airstream out behind the swather shed. And he leaves, not for the wilderness, but for a job that often seems demeaning in town.
While Ralph Beer confirms a family commitment to land and traditions, other writers like Tom McGuane and Richard Ford are establishing Montana as their home base. McGuane owns a ranch in Sweetgrass County where he raises cutting horses. He says his love for the natural world is a key to his writing.
And it's always the thing against which human activities are set against, not in a belittling way, but as I think we always need to be able to look out, even in the age of collapsed religions, and see something which is somewhat larger than we are. And that, I think, is something that I try to communicate in these sort of ridgetop views of the life that I've chosen to lead. And I should think that for some kinds of readers would be somewhat reassuring or somewhat warming.
The landscape and place names of Montana have also found their way into the writing of Richard Ford. He came to Montana when his wife Christina took a job here. Ford grew up in Mississippi and is sensitive to being categorized as a regional writer.
And indeed, my whole impulse as a writer is not to see the West as a region in any way that makes any difference to me, because when I get up close with it, what I find is nothing but diversity among people on a landscape.
Yet Ford thinks the anthology, The Last Best Place, is a positive effort to bring a sense of community to Montanans.
Everybody that I know in Montana seems to live as though she or he were the sun and all their neighbors were basically in their solar system. And that's, you know, that's the practical definition of what independence means. And so an anthology like The Last Best Place is quite wonderful because it becomes a kind of a codification of what we all share. Makes us seem less dissimilar and more each other's neighbor. I like that. That's what literature's for.
And it is a sense of community that brings so many writers to Montana. Some say it's like Paris in the 20s, cheap rent and a bar down the street where writers gather after a day at the typewriter. Others say the natural beauty and quiet lifestyle here nurtures the productive part of the mind. Whatever their reasons for coming here, all seem devoted to the tradition of Montana writing, and, as a poem by Richard Hugo suggests, making certain it goes on. For National Public Radio, I'm William Marcus in Missoula, Montana.
So, those are some of the stories that I used to tell on the radio, and with any luck, I'll be able to maybe do some more reporting like that in the future.
You know, William, there are many people that have come to Montana Public Radio, to public broadcasting like you, and stayed for their careers. You're very optimistic about this medium, about public broadcasting, public radio, and television. Why?
Because of everything that is happening in media. It is being torn apart. It is being challenged. And I think that stories will remain at the core of what's important. And however we deliver those stories, whether it's online or on the air, in podcasts, wherever people are listening, they're going to want to know stories about where they live. And we tell Montana stories better than anybody. People want to know what to trust. And I think public radio, public television, public media will be increasingly important at the core of all of that.
Well, you've been getting up at the crack of dawn every Monday for a very, very long time.
One more tomorrow.
Tomorrow will be the last morning edition shift and your last free forms. Mm-hmm. William, on behalf of the thousands of listeners and, of course, the staff here at Montana Public Radio, thank you for your amazing leadership and best of wishes in your retirement.
Thanks, Michael.